Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It is 9:47 p.m. and that is Pacific Summer Time, and today is June 28th. Got off the plane a couple hours ago. It's taken a while to get home. Friday night traffic in Los Angeles is quite surprisingly busy. But also, what is interesting is that you have Wi-Fi on the plane going to the UK, but there's no Wi-Fi on the plane coming back. And I think that's to do with US regulations. I was able to do quite a lot of work on the way over and even access the internet, but then I was going off of saved files on the way back. So just because technology allows us now to access the internet wherever we want, it still means that laws have to catch up. And that is something that tends to retard technological innovation in a number of different places. It's probably also going to be one of the things that is going to have an effect on the rollout of 5G. It's something that we've seen quite a lot of, especially with this acrimonious dispute about the role of China and Huawei in particular, as well as ZTE, in the rollout of the routers necessary to create 5G. I will talk more about technology in a moment, but I thought I would kick off this week with gold. Because it has so far been able to hold this move above $1,400, and I think that's something that is noteworthy. This is a very clear breakout. Now, one thing we know is that gold is volatile, and one of the reasons that people like to own gold is because it's volatile, that when it goes, it can really go. And that has certainly been the case over the course of the last 4 months, or excuse me, 4 weeks. It has rallied really quite significantly from the region of the trend mean. And this is occurring in a number of different currencies. But actually, before I go and look at some of those other currencies, there is something else that I think is really worth highlighting, because history doesn't repeat itself, but sometimes it really does rhyme. And that was particularly the case in 1999. We had a massive pop on the upside in 1999, and then it came all the way back down to test the lows. It really wasn't until about 2002 that we had had a consolidation, and then it really did start to move again on the upside. So it was the massive reaction against the prevailing downtrend that was the clear sign that the bull market was or the bear market was over. But it took a few years for the market to catch up. Now, if we think about what happened in 2016, that definitely broke the downtrend. The big move we had off of pretty depressed levels in 2016 broke the downtrend. And then it took 3 years to convince everyone that we were in a new bull market environment. On this occasion, the price did not get back down and test the lows, and we have had a progression of higher major reaction lows over the course of the last couple of years. So certainly we can say that history is rhyming. It doesn't repeat itself, but this is an important breakout. The defining characteristic of this base has been the failure of the price to hold moves above the $1,350 area. So that now represents an area of potential support. By the time the price even comes back down to test that level, it will largely coincide with the region of the trend mean. Trend mean is currently around the $1,295 area, and it is going to trend higher as long as prices continue to hold around this $1,400 area. But it's probably, if we're going to go back and think about the nature of bull markets in gold, then the price does tend to have explosive moves on the upside and then goes through lengthy consolidations and then has explosive moves on the upside again. So we've had a breakout and it is an important one. But gold is not going to complete a bull market in the space of 4 weeks. So this is also something we need to remember, that commodities are best bought following reactions, and there will inevitably be reactions. Well, then I think it is also particularly relevant to look at gold in other currencies. And when we think about how it is doing in dollars, well, that obviously has some geopolitical considerations. But it is worth highlighting that it did break out in renminbi first. And I'm going to put the correct ticker in here because if we make it a currency, it's not going to let me do that. So when we look at it in renminbi, it broke out a month ago. And it was the sustained move above 9,000 renminbi was the really key level. And this is still a really very impressive rebound, going from 9 to 10,000 renminbi in the space of a month. Well, 10,000 is obviously a big psychological level, and it was an area of support back between 2011 and 2013, and it was the sustained move below it that really confirmed that we'd had the massive reaction against the prevailing trend and right-hand extension, and then the downward the downtrend. Now, the question is whether 9,000 is going to represent an area of support. Then also in Australian dollars, the price of gold is at a new all-time high. And I think that's also really quite important because it very clearly starts to ram home the point that there have been a lot of currencies that have been weaker than gold for a prolonged period of time. For example, gold has been trending higher against the Brazilian real for most of the last 15 years. And yes, there have been some periods where we've had lengthy consolidations, but this is still a reasonably consistent trend. And then, of course, you have the Canadian dollar. What's I think also worth highlighting is that gold is breaking out in the currencies of major producers of gold. So that is going to have an effect on the willingness of people in those countries to not only buy gold but to mine gold. And in rand, it is back in the region of the 20,000 level, and that had been the peak back in 2016. There are some negotiations going on right now in South Africa about the conditions for miners, and they are asking for aggressive wage hikes. Quite whether they're going to get them or not is still very much open to negotiation. But with gold starting to advance here, then mines are going to be getting more profitable. And that's particularly in view of the fact that they have not been spending as much money on mergers and acquisitions activity. So the Gold Bugs Index, which is an index of unhedged gold miners, has rallied now rather significantly from about 150 to 200 in the space of the last 4 or 5 weeks. And it's now testing this 200 level, but the most important thing it's done has put in a higher reaction low and broken the sequence of lower rally highs since the peak back in 2016. So and this is a really very significant change in the trend. And I think these are some of the more important points. But when then we look at, for example, the South African, and of course this is a local currency index, but the South African Gold Miners Index has now rallied rather significantly from the region of the trend mean. It's obviously much more volatile because of the twin values for the currency and for the gold price. Then, of course, we should be thinking about if gold is doing this, well, what is happening in terms of the other precious metals? Well, palladium is right back in the region of its peak from back in March, and it was off its lows in here today. But when we look at this on a weekly basis, then it was due a reversion to the mean. It had that, and now we've had a pretty impressive rebound. Well, we may yet get some consolidation around this $1,500 area. But Palladium continues to trade above the price of gold, and it's at a not far off a multiple of the price of platinum. Well, platinum has obviously had some really very significant issues that have come up as a result of the diesel cheating scandal and the reluctance of people to have anything to do with the metal as a result of that. But at today's levels, platinum is objectively cheap. When you start to think about the cost of gold jewelry, platinum is generally sold on a 95% purity level, or quoted as 950, and 18 karat gold is generally, or 3/4 gold, or 75% gold is the usually what is used in jewelry. Well, even allowing for the fact that platinum is approximately 11% more dense than gold, even if one were to use platinum in exactly the same quantities to produce a piece of jewelry, it should be coming in cheaper than 18 karat gold at these prices. And that's a really strange condition. Of course, you're not going to be able to buy it at those kinds of levels, but there are gold, I mean, I certainly know that locally here in Los Angeles, there are dealers that are selling it at very close to spot. And that's, I think, a rather profound condition that we have where platinum is so very cheap. And because it is so cheap relative to palladium, it is only a matter of time before we get substitution in terms of catalytic converters. You can't use palladium in a diesel catalytic converter, but you can certainly use platinum in a gasoline catalytic converter. And one of the reasons why a company like Lonmin was able to move back into profitability is because they closed so many of their operations, and they went back to their most profitable seams and just stopped mining. Well, that obviously was something that is going to put them at odds with the mining unions, who generally don't want anyone to ever cut any workers, and generally also refuse to engage in labor-saving devices because it would result in a lower headcount for the workforce. That does represent a challenge in South Africa. So what happens in terms of South Africa is obviously going to have a material impact on the platinum price. But one thing that we can say very clearly in this chart is that there is a sequence of higher reaction lows, and platinum is starting to steady from the $800 area. Even a move to 1,000, well, that would be a 20% advance from the $800 area, or 25% advance, excuse me, from the $800 area. And that would really only be getting back up to the upper side of the range from 2017. So we really are at very depressed levels. And it's a pretty similar story for silver. So when we think about the fact that silver today is only still at around the $15 and change level, but it has rallied rather impressively over the course of June. And now we are at in the region of the trend mean. And if we were thinking about the mania argument, it is really the only real evidence in the precious metal sector that we have of a very clear acceleration was from silver back in 2010 and 11. It got all the way up to $50, which exceeded the peak put in during the Hunt attempt to corner the market in the early 1980s. I remember when David and I were sitting together back in 2003 and 4 and 5, we were thinking that by the time the bull market had ended, that those peaks would be exceeded. Well, that happened in 2011, and then we had this massive decline and a really quite lengthy Type 3 base formation is underway in silver. it really does look like we are not going to see it come back below the $14 area. And every time it gets below 15, it has popped back on the upside. So we're getting failed downside breaks below 15. That suggests that there is demand coming through at the lower side of this range. Silver is considered to be poor man's gold. It's also considered to be high beta gold. So that does raise the question that when you have such a multiple where the price of gold is not far off 100 times the price of silver, and that in historically at least we've never seen it get cheaper than 100, then that does suggest that on a relative basis silver is cheap. The one caveat, of course, is that we do need to pay particular attention to the chart action, because there was a time when platinum had spent very little time trading at a level below the gold price, and now it's still at about 1.6 times the price of or gold is 1.6 times the price of platinum, which is very close to an all-time peak, and it has been trending higher for a considerable amount of time. So I am rather tempted to take the gold-silver ratio at just a simple valuation, because silver prices do appear to be stabilizing. But that is, I think, obviously contingent on those prices continuing to steady, that we definitely do need to have some support in the market. Well, let's then think about what is going on. Why is it that we're seeing this change in the precious metal markets? There has been a catalyst. It simply didn't just start overnight. It's not that gold mines have suddenly stopped. Well, we know that central banks are buying gold, most particularly Russia and China. We also know that ETF holdings of gold have been trending higher, but that's really in a modest fashion. I think the most important thing about ETF holdings of gold is that they didn't really go down after the surge in 2016. They had generally continued higher, and they were at a new high in here today. So I think that's an important fact. But the bigger picture is not so much about the price of gold rallying, but the values of fiat currencies falling. And that's where we have very clear evidence. There is I think, a very obvious effort by the US government to reduce or to remove some of the supports for the US dollar. They are going to be cutting rates next month. They are going to stop reducing the size of the balance sheet in September, and there's even the potential that they may bring forward the timetable for that into July or even August. So that's a potential, there is certainly the potential here that the supports for the dollar are moderating. Then we have the fact that the European Union are looking at going for negative interest rates. Well, it's something in the order of $13 trillion in bonds now have negative yields, and the German 10-year yield went to minus 32 basis points in here today. So this is a further extension of this contraction. When we look at what is going on in terms of the government bond markets, well, we can see too that there has been a pause in around the 2% level for the 10-year treasury, but there has been a distinct absence of a rally. And that is representative of continued demand for bonds. So investors are very eager to buy bonds, and that's against a background where we know that there's the likelihood of continued quantitative easing. There is the likelihood of supports for currencies being removed. But I think bond investors are beginning to price in that valuations are rather high, that we're about to get an additional source of liquidity hitting the market. And because of this dearth of yield, people are willing to go into the bond markets because of the momentum, and it's the momentum is supplementing the total return in because of the absence of yield. And then, of course, there are the facts that the global economy has been slowing down. What's interesting is that the French economy has just started to turn around, and their PMI has surprised on the upside. And the contrast between the performance of some European shares and the French CAC 40 is, I think, rather well made here. It is definitely outperforming and is coming up to the upper side of a more than 2-year range. That does hold out the prospect that it would be among the first of the major European indices to take out its 2007 or 2008 highs. Then we have Germany. Well, Germany has certainly outperformed over the course of the last decade. It had already taken out its highs. And I can't type very effectively, so excuse me. When we look at what Germany has been doing over the course of the last decade, it had broken out very clearly in 2013. Now we have this ranging consolidation and period of really quite profound volatility over the course of the last few years. Well, now the index is starting to steady above the trend mean, and it is pushing on the upside here. So there is the potential now that stock market investors are moving back towards Europe, because Europe generally has been rather dependent on a weak currency to support bullish action in the stock market, because in at least in nominal terms. But now that we're starting to see the dollar weaken, what that is effectively creating is a liquidity fueled move, because it is increasing the value of money sitting on the balance sheets of various central banks. So when we then think about the fact that it has been central bank balance sheets have been the primary, or at least it's been the measure of just how much liquidity is out there in the market. Well, this measure has bounced pretty impressively in early June, and it continues to expand mildly. Well, the weaker the dollar gets, the more liquidity that will push out into the global economy. So that's one of the most important points, that we are seeing a very clear potential move to weaken the value or the purchasing power of fiat currencies. And that is also because the bond market, I think in particular, is already pricing in that we are going to have modern monetary theory implemented. Of course, it could be argued that we're halfway there already, that the Federal Reserve has pretty much acquiesced to the Trump administration's demands for lower interest rates. When James Bullard, who is considered the biggest dove on the Federal Reserve Board, says that the interest rate cut in July is pretty much an insurance cut. Well, that's basically telling us that the Federal Reserve now is anticipating data rather than reacting to it. And that is rather different. That, more than any other factor, what that really tells us is that the Federal Reserve will do anything to ensure they don't get a recession. So that is one of the reasons why the gold market is doing better, because they are willing to flog the currency or debauch the value of the currency in order to support the economy. And that means that anything that is of fixed supply is likely to rise in value. Well, that is also a significant reason behind the very big move we've seen in Bitcoin over the course of the last few months. And it found support in here today around the 10,000 level. What I would be very keen to point out is just how much of a difference you get in the nominal chart versus the logarithmic scale chart. The vast majority of people that are investing in cryptocurrencies are still retail, and that means that they're investing on a cash basis rather than on a leveraged basis. And if that's the case, if it is still a cash-driven market, well, then a log scale chart is much more important and valuable than an arithmetic scale chart. And we can see evidence of that now, that the consistency of the trend up since the beginning of March is such that you get these explosive breakouts, and then the price ranges for approximately a month, and then you have another explosive breakout. Well, the most recent breakout took the price up to about 14,000, and the range now is going to be somewhere in the order of about 4,000. So this is a somewhat larger reaction than we had previously, but not necessarily in percentage terms. And it is the percentage terms is probably going to be the most important point here. Also, that it has bounced from the 10,000 level, which is a big psychological level, is also important. As long as the length of the ranges remains reasonably steady, and we get at least a 3 week pause, well, then that would suggest that the next big move on the upside could quite easily take it back to the peak we saw in 2017. So then there is the scope that it could potentially exceed that. So as long as the trend remains consistent, then we can continue to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. There are only going to be 20 something million Bitcoin minted, and the quantity or the reward for mining is going to halve a year from now. Well, that is also one of the reasons why the price is rising, that because there is now a very clear argument to support the limited supply view. That's also one of the reasons why gold is doing better. The fact that gold and Bitcoin are rallying together is representative of this argument that's moving in favor of limited supply. Well, limited supply is, I think it would be difficult to say that there's a limited supply of bonds, and they are trading at rather incredible levels. But nonetheless, they are benefiting from the asset price inflation, and the total return on the 10-year Treasury future continues to extend its breakout. I continue to think that it is likely we're going to see 1.5% tested in terms of the US Treasury yield. And who's to say that the yields on government bonds in the USA and UK are not going to move negative when the major economies in the rest of the world all have some negative yielding bonds? It would seem that the exceptionalism of the UK and the USA is unlikely to last. Then we should be thinking about what's going on in terms of the stock market. Well, the S&P 500 is right in the region of its peak, and this looks like a bullish consolidation. One thing we know is that in major ranges, like we've seen over the last 18 months, supply and demand come back into balance. And that also means that the arguments for both supply and demand are back in balance. Well, we had the big pullback, we've had an equally impressive rebound. Now we're starting to see evidence of new sources of liquidity coming to the market. This is almost textbook in terms of the US presidential cycle. You generally expect to get a growth scare in the first half of the third year of the presidential cycle, and then that is when the Federal Reserve starts to get concerned about a recession, so they start easing again. That benefits the incumbent, And we then get easy monetary policy through until just after the election. Well, again, when we go back and think about modern monetary theory, and that would be simply formalizing this informal relationship between the government and the central bank. It's, I think, rather naive to think that the central banks are fully independent. Of course, they are influenced by political motive, and that would be very difficult to completely stamp out. If we do get to, I personally don't believe that we're going to have modern monetary theory implemented until there is a recession. But it's almost certainly going to become a topic of conversation in the US presidential election. Not least because I do believe it is reasonably likely that the Democratic Party nominee is going to be someone from the progressive side of the party. And that would suggest that how they're going to fund their spending programs is with money they don't have. And that suggests that there is going to be a lot of debt provision. There is going to be an equally large amount of central bank buying. We could be moving into another round of quantitative easing, and this provision of liquidity is likely to be beneficial to asset prices. And that's certainly looking like what the S&P is telling us. When we then look at the NASDAQ 100, then it is also right in the region of its peak, and this also looks like a bullish consolidation. Upside weekly key reversals with follow-through are about the clearest signs that we are back in a demand-dominated environment as one might hope for. We also saw some interesting action today in the banking sector, and it is now pushing back above the trend mean, and there's two higher reaction lows there, and this is positive action. All of the major banks in the USA now have passed their stress tests, and they are going to be given permission to increase their dividends. So that is net positive. It suggests also that the deleveraging of the banking sector has been successful. The risk that they have is more in the loans they've extended to the, excuse me, the long flight is starting to catch up with me. But it's the risks that they have to the shadow banking sector, or money that they would have loaned to the non-listed banks or the non-bank lenders, whether that is in the property markets or in the private equity markets. That's where I believe the bubble is. And it's, I think it, there's a very clear rationale for that. When you have got free money that has been sloshing around for more than a decade, then you're going to get some misallocation of capital. There's going to be malinvestment. There is going to have been, or we know that there was a competition for yield, which has been pushing up the values of some of these companies that are never going to make money, or at least never turn a profit. That's where the risks are. I think when we think about the fact that the quantity of dry powder that private equity companies now have is in the order of 3 trillion, that the leverage ratios of the corporate sector are in excess of where they were in 2008, and that investors are piling into these private equity ventures. And now that they are starting to go sour, with Neil Woodford's fund running into trouble, and the fact that there was a statistic that it was 25% of the fund supermarket Hargreaves Lansdown's clients, upwards of 300,000 individuals had positions in Neil Woodford's funds and have obviously now had their ability to sell been taken away from them. Then we have this ongoing drama with H2O funds sponsored by Natixis in Europe, and then you have the Vision Fund set up by SoftBank and Saudi Arabia, where that was only a year ago, and now they're looking at IPOing it. So that doesn't say much for the ability of those investors to have bought at attractive levels that they are so eager to sell already. Well, therefore, that is where the risk is. We know where the risks are. But it's in the non-listed sector. So obviously, there are going to be companies that do list, and they list with very clearly saying in their prospectuses that they may never make money. But because we are getting more liquidity coming into the market, then they are starting to do better. Uber was up at a new high in here today, and Lyft does have some base formation completion characteristics. So I think that is something that really does need to be considered here, that some of these companies are doing better because of the liquidity that is coming into the market. It's only when we get to a point where this liquidity comes out of the market, or we get another bout of fiscal rectitude taking root in central banks or in governments, that this drive to asset price inflation is going to be really challenged. Then, when I think about the domestic economies, well, mid-cap shares and small-cap shares do give us I think some insight into what's going on in terms of the domestic economy, and the Russell 2000, in a manner really quite similar to the banks, has pushed back above the trend mean. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is right at the upper side of its range, and the Transportation Index is also now starting to steady from this 10,000 level. It's still lagging, and there is, I think, a narrowing of breadth here. But then I think we can also look at the largest cap shares. The FANG index is unweighted, but it is now pushing back up towards the upper side of its range, and the Philadelphia Semiconductors Index has demonstrated that it can find support around this 1400 point level against a background where there's still uncertainty about China. The thing that I was most excited about in the technology sector this week was the publicizing of the announcement by Google back in March that they've got exponential growth. What we've been conditioned to expect from Moore's Law was that innovation would double about every 18 months. But what they're seeing with quantum computing now is that it's squaring every few months. And that's incredibly profound in terms of the pace of technological innovation. And that is something that we do see. If you take the exponential growth rate to its logical conclusion, then by the time it reaches its end, the biggest doubling is the last one. And that's something that is worth considering, that the pace of technological innovation is trending higher in an exponential manner. And what that means is that the time that it takes to get to market with new technologies will shorten, that these are incredibly profound developments. So one thing that I think is important also is that over the course of the last year, the innovations that we've seen in the cryptocurrency markets have got us increasingly close to commercialization. Bitcoin is more about a limited supply argument. Ethereum is more about smart contracts, and I think really trying to eat the lunch of the banking sector. IOTA, which is the Internet of Things, so it's even got it in the title, is looking at securing transactions across multiple platforms. And that's, I think, one of the interesting points. IOTA could potentially have the potential for people to rent out their spare capacity. It could even be a commercial way for people to earn rent on their computers, or for even the Bitcoin miners to devote some of their computing power to sustaining the network. The more people that use it, the faster it gets. So that's also an important characteristic. But because of this ability to allow others to use just communal computing power, then it creates a massive supercomputer. And that also means that people will have potentially limitless resources at their disposal for a very modest fee in order to create access to supercomputers for just about everybody. So that's a very clear potential use case for IOTA. But then if we have quantum computers, well, that is very much driven towards a the provision of software, or it would be really more like computing as a service. So that's another potential use case here, that we are going to have quantum computers in the market within 12 months if this pace of innovation persists. So that's obviously going to be beneficial for companies like Google. Of course, quite when it will have enough of revenue to provide a anything close to the quantity of money that they make from advertising is a completely separate question. I don't know why I'm not getting my charts here. There it is. But what is interesting is Google is responding more to antitrust risk right now than it is to the innovations that it is driving in quantum computing or in autonomous vehicles. And this massive computing power and the increases in computing power are potentially something that could help to drive the autonomous revolution further, faster. We're still a long way from the kinds of delivery that I think people really want to see in terms of autonomous vehicles. But one thing that I do think is important is to think about, in terms of the technology sector and the threats that are arising, we have seen a really big change in perceptions towards technology over the course of the last 3 or 4 years. The rise of populism and the disillusionment that people have with the power of the technology firms and the ability of elections to be tampered with, that really does represent a change in terms of sentiment. Generally speaking, capitalism trends towards consolidation. The strong consume the weak, so that you're left with less companies. I certainly know that when I first created the list of autonomies back in 2012, then we've seen substantial numbers of those same companies consuming one another. Well, the ultimate aim then, or I guess if you were to just simply play that out, then ultimately there would only be one company. Of course, that is never going to be the case. So something has to happen to curtail that consolidation due to of capital in the hands of a smaller number of companies, and antitrust is the answer. But what is, I think, important to remember is generally it's before the demergers occur that prices pull back. And subsequently, that the kind of research, at least that I've seen, is that it is after you've basically, when you own the share, then you end up with shares of both the original company and the pieces of it that have been split out. And generally, on aggregate, you end up better off after only a couple of years. It's very similar to the kinds of hard forks you get in the cryptocurrency world. So I think there is a risk of antitrust, and there is a risk that it is going to have an effect on the business models of some of these companies, but that it doesn't necessarily need to be a terminal in nature, provided they can continue to do the kinds of business that they've been performing over the course of the last decade and longer. the pace of technological innovation is particularly acute in artificial intelligence, in the quantum computing realm, and also in biotechnology, and of course in energy. So these are really quite profound. These are the kinds of things that are driving innovation, but they're driving the secular bull market hypothesis. I think that when we look at the world in general, there is the very clear potential that we're going to see emerging markets become much more favored in terms of investor attitudes, for the simple reason that the dollar declining is going to be beneficial for these countries, not least those that have got a large quantity of US dollar denominated debt. When we then just simply address their chart patterns in nominal terms, well, what we're presented with by and large are uptrends, and those uptrends are more impressive than what we've seen for in the majority of Europe. That is equally true in Brazil. I did see a rumor that Bolsonaro had some one of the government pilots had a couple of kilos of cocaine on the plane on the way to the G20, which is a bit of a no-no, but it hasn't done anything really for the potential for the Bovespa to continue to push higher. When we think about the outlook for emerging markets, then we are definitely starting to see a move towards the sector generally. But Mexico, having rallied all the way back to the trend mean, is now starting to pull back from it. This is one index that does not look like it is going to join the party in terms of the emerging markets. I think when we look at what's going on in the emerging markets, well, then there is increasing evidence that growth is starting to bottom. That if we are going to get more monetary stimulus, if we're going to get more fiscal stimulus, then that should be beneficial for the global economy. That should benefit the emerging markets in particular. If we get commodity prices bottoming, that should also benefit them. But then, of course, we have the demographic dividend, and the fact that India's population is likely to exceed that of China at some point in the next 10 years, and that today more than half the population is less than 25 years old. So that is a massive source of new workers for the global economy. Then, of course, we have Africa, which is where the true growth engine of population growth is going to be for the next probably the next 40 years. So that is where we can anticipate demand for just about everything increasing. Then, of course, we have the fact that the USA is going to become. I think I need to probably restart my computer. That's my wireless keyboard is not picking up my keystrokes. But when we look at, for example, the oil price, and I don't know what that is, so that this is quite peculiar. I know that that is Brent crude. When we look at the oil price, it does go through periods of quite consistent trending, and then those periods give way to much more volatile trading. Well, we're now in one of the more volatile periods of trading, but it's occurring within a much broader environment of a range between approximately $45 and $85. And we're pretty much mid-range right now. There's a lot of the USA's oil is economic around the $55 area. Well, that does suggest that it is going to be difficult to see prices come back below that level. But the USA is going to become an increasingly more prolific and swing producer in terms of the global oil markets. And I think that is something that is going to upend the geopolitical balance. because it is going to see it competing with a number of its old enemies, not least Iran and Russia. It also frees up American allies from having to play nice with countries that it has got differences with, or they have differences with, because they can get their oil from somewhere else and their gas from somewhere else. That's obviously what the big argument is right now about the Nord Stream pipeline in Germany, that the USA would much prefer if Germany were to be buying its gas on an LNG basis rather than piping it from Russia. So there is a geopolitical contest going on to control the trade with Europe. Certainly, Russia wants to be exporting energy into Europe, and so does the USA. China has been buying ports in Greece. They are setting up the renminbi trading in London, and there's the potential for a an exchange connect system between Europe, between the UK and China. So China is definitely moving geopolitically to try and make friends and create not just alliances but reliances across Europe on Chinese spending. And that is also something that should be of interest to NATO. But what we've definitely seen also is that as the USA becomes more isolationist, then other countries are stepping into the breach and providing the kind of spending power to Europe that it is particularly in need of right now, considering that it is still reeling from the response or otherwise of the governments in the region to the credit crisis. If I try to draw it all together, it does look like we're going to see asset prices doing better from here. That bonds might be overextended, but there's no evidence that they're over. That it is likely we're going to get modern monetary theory. In other words, there's going to be a lot more liquidity sloshing around, and that should be beneficial to asset prices. There is the clear risk that that is going to form a bubble in the unlisted sector. It is going to represent a significant headwind to highly leveraged corporations in terms of their balance sheets when inflation does pick up in response to modern monetary theory, and that would then begin to pressure interest rates higher. So it is only really at that point that we're going to have some of the challenges that are easy to predict actually coming to fruition. In the meantime, gold and Bitcoin are representing this favoring by investors of assets that cannot simply be printed into existence. And I think with that, I will leave you for today and wish all the best to all of you.